36 degrees were seen in Kenosha, 32 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College and Director of the Clawson Center and author of the book After the Cold War. A columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country and indeed around the globe as well. And Professor Sear joins us once a month to offer his perspective and analysis of various current events. And this, of course, needless to say, is going to be the final time for 2014. So we'll not only take a look at what is currently most important, but maybe take a moment or two to look back over this year that is about to come to a close and maybe look ahead to what might be ahead in 2015, although who knows what. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be here. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you and our listeners. And I really appreciate that especially generous introduction. If you want to just keep going, why, that's fine.
Yeah. No, I've exhausted myself just doing that. I must say, too, this is I'm just kind of realizing as I sit down that having been just about literally consumed by Carthage's Christmas festival,
yes,
which occurred this past weekend. Well, thanks.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I'm not going to burst into song, but it was just wonderful. I had a chance to go Sunday night, and it was terrific. And people who aren't aware of it should be aware that about this time every year, there are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday performances. No charge. You have to make a reservation, however, and there are places always packed, and it's hard to get a place to park, and it's just wonderful.
Mm. Well, glad you enjoyed it, and it was also gratifying to hear from many people, including many, many Carthage alums scattered across the country who weren't there in person but experienced it via live streaming over Carthage's website. So it was the next best thing to being there. I only bring it up because I feel like between that and the opening of The Sound of Music at the Racine Theater Guild, two big projects on my plate, I feel like I know next to nothing about what's happened in the world outside of my own little backyard and all that has kept me so busy. So,
well, you should bring it up. I'm always telling you, Greg, you're never going to get ahead in the media world if you don't shamelessly promote yourself and constantly beat
but
the
drum. But I feel like I have not been paying attention to the rest of the world the way I typically do. So fortunately you have, as usual. So so here we go with a lot of different things to talk about. Actually, one of the rather tense situations that maybe you can shed a little bit of light on is the fact that today we are expecting the publication or the release of a report on CIA interrogation techniques. And evidently there is enough concern about what this report might say, might reveal, that U.S. Marines around the world are on sort of a heightened sense of alert, as are our embassies abroad, because of possible fallout that might occur in the wake of the release of this information. First of all, tell us if we even know a whole lot about what might be contained in this report and what the fears are that that this might touch off.
Well, the latter part is easier. There's concern that it might spark and stimulate terrorist attacks. Mind you, the media, not this program, but a lot of the commercial media in these turbulent times, which we were discussing off the air, and a lot of politicians, speaking of self-promotion and seeking advantage, have an interest in underscoring the potential for some sort of vast Islamic revolt or terrorism connected with this. It's extremely important today, more important than ever before, to discount what you hear from media types and political types. Not you and me, of course, but I'm speaking quite seriously. The other point is that the report deals with an inherently ambiguous situation in moral as well as political terms and policy terms. I've had a chance to think about this throughout my adult life, and if you're at war, it's essential to survival and success to do things that basically are immoral. I do think there are occasions when it's extremely important to use torture, and I would be attentive to, and defensible, and I would be very attentive as a serious person, and that's what our listeners are, to the counterpoints and rebuttals, in effect, from CIA officers who participated in things related to this, especially during the first few years after the 9/11 attacks and our overthrow of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan and then our invasion of Iraq, which was not directly related to the terrorist attacks, but occurred at the same in the same time period. I think it's extremely important to be attentive to that dimension. And some of our leaders, I think, are more perceptive and educational than others. I've been for a long time a great fan of Senator Dianne Feinstein, and there are others in the Congress who will have useful things to say on this, and members of the administration, but I find her particularly perceptive and responsible. I don't always agree with her, but I certainly think she's a particularly important person in the cacophony of media and political commentary to listen to. I think she'd be a very good president. She's been very consistent over time, like General Sherman, in saying that she enjoys being in the Senate, unlike Sherman, but she's not going to run for president.
Mm-hmm. What is the point of this report being issued? I mean, I guess maybe another question or another way to ask it is, why is this report being issued at all or shared at all? What is the point of doing so?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it gets to the other side of the ambiguity. We are a representative democracy and a government of law, in a law-abiding society, however we miss the mark, on occasion. That's the overall culture in this country, and we all should be thankful for that. We have a right to know within limits, as long as it doesn't jeopardize national security. Now, members of Congress are vitally interested in the public interest. They're also interested in getting reelected. And especially since the establishment of the Senate Committee on Intelligence Matters after the Vietnam period, there has been a constant problem of leaks and politicians who reveal too much and classified information coming out of Congress. I think it's both to respect the right of the people to know within responsible limits and also to help deflect some of this pressure that's there anyway that the report is being issued.
Mm-hmm. Probably, if anything has been of a predominant concern on the national front in the last several weeks, and even stretching before that a little bit, it has been the mounting sense of concern that is swirling around events in Ferguson, Missouri, but not just there. The places all across the country, the perception of unfair or discriminatory practices by law enforcement against African Americans and other minorities, and this rift which has really been in many respects widening, and of course touching off protests across the country, and as well a lot of very heated discussion and argument over this. And of course it's also prompted some really interesting, more kind of general philosophical questions about where we are as a nation when it comes to matters of race at this moment in time, when we have an African-American president and yet with this really sort of ugly tension in the air around this. First of all, I wonder if you are to any extent surprised by the way this issue is playing out right now. I mean, is it a surprise to you?
No. One of the advantages of having been around for a while is you do develop some perspective. That doesn't mean that you're right, and it doesn't even mean that you're wiser than people who aren't quite so old. But I did achieve a consciousness, went to college in the 60s, and that was the one time in my life when I thought our country was coming apart, despite the strong economy. Riots, very, very destructive, and deadly riots in major cities around the country. Student demonstrations became a way of life. It seemed unrest was constant. During Lyndon Johnson's last year in office, it's curious to me that there's quite fascinating that there's this to me very strange nostalgia for LBJ currently. I think there are understandable reasons for that. A huge hit play on Broadway is All the Way, about President Lyndon Johnson's, to put it mildly and politely, forceful leadership styles, both in the Senate and in the White House. But to get back to answering your question, I don't minimize the importance of these issues and the seriousness of what's happened, these killings of African Americans. But it's very much in line with our tradition. I was watching a very impressive police official in New York City on, I think it was Friday's Week in Review on PBS, talking about how protest is a strong part of our tradition. It's a right of Americans. It's the foundation of our country, quite literally. But he went on to talk about the importance of remaining in the law and thinking about how to be most effective. Speaking of police officials, I think Terry McCarthy in Chicago, a city constantly and continually troubled with violence, poor race relations, tremendous continuing segregation for all the other positive aspects of the economy and society in Chicago. What he has to say about these matters I find to be quite impressive. He has a very, very difficult job. He suffered a minor heart attack this year, I think. He is extremely responsible and insightful about the difficulties of relating law enforcement to the community, especially poorer, less advantaged parts of the community, and by no means just African-American components. A point made by David Brooks, secondly, a New York Times columnist. He's kind of the house conservative. He's not that conservative. He's on PBS just about every Friday. He made the point that police have become very heavily armored in this country, which I find quite insightful. The statistics are staggering of the degree to which very heavy automatic weapons, armored vehicles, very destructive weaponry of all kinds since 9/11 has become pervasive in police departments around the country.
In other words, the average police officer on an average day is more heavily armed than he or she would have been, say, 20 years ago.
Not necessarily, but sending out SWAT teams, sending out heavily armored special operations and strike forces. Police, not the military, has become very much a way of life. The statistics to which SWAT teams are deployed in this country compared to just a few years ago, and certainly even 10 years ago, is stunning. And it's worth taking a look at reliable data on that point. Police have it's important for all of us that police are able to protect themselves, and they have a right to armament. But Brooks, and this gets kind of primordial. He said, you know, it develops a kind of macho atmosphere that can lead to using force early. Okay. And that resonates with me. I think that is extremely perceptive and not much discussed. And one of the reasons you and I sit around once a month or more is to try to look for things that aren't readily discussed.
Right. That is an interesting point. I mean, as you began talking, my immediate reaction was, but wait a minute, there wasn't a SWAT team involved in the killing in Ferguson, Missouri, or in most of these other instances that we're talking about. But the fact that perhaps is fostering a culture that was not there at one point, or I think you called it a mindset, which you know, kind of a trigger happy, shoot now, think about it later kind of thing. I mean, taken to an extreme, or in the case of a difficult situation, maybe a young officer or an officer for whatever reason who has such a predilection, it's a recipe for a very dangerous situation, the potential for very bad things to occur.
Yeah. It's also important not to lump incidents together. Ferguson, you know, I'm sitting far removed from these events, and I'm very fortunate in that regard. But Ferguson seems quite different from New York, the New York event. It's very hard to understand why not a murder charge, but some charge wasn't brought against the officer who was responsible for the death of that gentleman.
Right. And, of course, you're pointing to something really important here, too, which is our tendency exactly to lump together unique events, each one with its own unique set of circumstances, but it is just so easy to do. It's tempting to do, but it's a mistake. Nevertheless, no matter where you fall on the spectrum or what your concerns are about this event, we have to be careful not to fall into that pattern of lumping events together and drawing a lot of generalities that maybe should not be drawn.
Finally, you referred to presidential leadership and in the area of video of a much more positive sort. I would commend to people who are interested, and we all should be interested in these matters, important presidential statements related to race relations and the use of force, and especially the use of federal power, readily available on the internet are videos of four extremely important addresses on the subject. President George Herbert Walker Bush addressed the nation during the Los Angeles riots in the wake of the acquittal of four police officers.
The Rodney King incident.
Who were involved in beating Rodney King. Secondly, President Eisenhower's address to the nation when he sent the 101st Airborne Division, going back, President Bush was 20 years ago. This is in the late 50s. He sent the 101st Airborne Division into Little Rock, Arkansas to enforce the Supreme Court's desegregation decision, the implementation of the Brown versus Board decision ending school segregation in 1954. That's a remarkably subtle and perceptive address, which in no way condones, in fact condemns, mob violence and this kind of racist behavior, without ever using the term racist. Mm. But he also underscores the rule of law. And in the case of both presidents, there's an emphasis to appeal to the population as a whole, not just the minority community. Mm. Finally, President Kennedy's address in 1963, after the march, I think it may have been before the March on Washington, but prompted by his reluctant introduction of civil rights legislation to Congress, which became the Civil Rights Act that LBJ got through in 64. And in 1968, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, Robert Kennedy did a now legendary impromptu address standing on a flat in the back of a flatbed truck in Indianapolis, Indiana. Cities went up in flames, literally, inner city areas around the U.S. at that terrible time. Indianapolis was quiet, and politicians, political leaders of significance, especially the Kennedy brothers, in my view, are much shrouded and clouded in legend and myth, and that's no exaggeration in this case. Robert Kennedy was often quite inarticulate, especially when under stress, and he really found his voice in this particular address. But again, the emphasis was on the need to, as a very diverse country, as well as a very large population, the need to cooperate. Mm. You know, the search for finding levels at which very different people can cooperate. Mm.
I was thinking about that RFK moment where he was, in a sense, announcing to this crowd in Indianapolis. I mean, many of them, probably the vast majority of them, did not yet know the news that King
right,
had been assassinated.
He announced it, yeah.
Right, and then essentially off the cuff, or certainly without any kind of written notes in front of him, spoke very eloquently to try to calm the anger and to soothe the anguish of that crowd there. I was thinking about that, oddly enough, because of something made. A point made last night during the telecast of the Packer-Falcons game, because they were mentioning the fact that it was during a telecast, let's see, it would have been 1980, is that 35 years ago? The assassination of John Lennon was announced on... during a telecast. And what the point they were making is that in that time, and it would be even more true back in 1968, where you didn't have cell phones, you didn't have 24/7 news channels and this and that, you didn't have people texting each other, information was disseminated in a very different way and much more slowly. And so when that announcement was made, actually, by Howard Cosell in that telecast back in 1980 that John Lennon had been assassinated, nobody watching otherwise knew. And nobody in that stadium knew. I mean, nobody at that football game knew until they walked out into the parking lot. Would they even know that news? And it just underscores how that was a time when... In many cases, very dramatically, in an instant, you would learn tremendously important news and the importance of delivering that news as carefully and rationally and accurately as possible was even more important versus now, where information is sort of just instantly there in a myriad of different sources, and there's no way to really even control that moment of initial announcement. It's just interesting to think about the way the world has changed.
Yes, and there's much discussion of instant communication and media globalization electronically facilitated by radio and then especially television long before the internet became more than a Defense Department tool. And a lot of it, of course, is very superficial. It's very difficult, I think, to grasp the most fundamental meanings of what you're talking about. But that again was a change in the 60s. I think the television had become pervasive in this country, and the national but also global network of electronic communications really did become a web of sorts at that time. I think especially for younger people, Robert Kennedy's remarks might well be particularly instructive and insightful at a time when there was a tremendous amount of media emphasis but also real attention to and concern about youthful unrest in this country but also around the world. Contrary to myth and legend, Bobby Kennedy was in very serious trouble politically in 68. He was losing, not winning, even though he won these primaries, which were of minor importance. His staff definitely did not want him to go out, especially to address African Americans. When they got the news about it, he overruled his staff. He eluded the police, who tried to keep him in his hotel room. It showed a moment of real courage when he was under. He was naturally a target in a way that others were not, five years after the murder of his brother. But it showed a real sense of commitment on his part, and indeed it paid off.
Of course, it's interesting to think about now some of those very same issues and concerns and divides still being in place, but in a very different world where we conduct our discussions / arguments in very different fashion. And it kind of makes you wonder, are we...
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, in this media pervades... This world pervaded by media.
Oh, you can go viral.
Yeah. Well, right. Exactly. Well, and I mean, so, you know, there can be this video clip of something and it's suddenly all over the world. And
right. And
this instantaneous exchange of information, I mean, that did not occur in 1968. So the question then is, when we have something like this very serious racial divide, are we in a better or worse position in terms of trying to address that in a meaningful way and coming to some kind of reconciliation or healing or whatever you want to call it? But is that more likely or less likely to happen in the kind of world in which we live?
Well, there's more than just the media involved. And for all our problems, we're a vastly more egalitarian and vastly wealthier, collectively, society. We should be talking about income disparities, but the average American, except for the very poorest, is doing far better. And we do have an African-American president in the White House. Our discussion does underscore the importance of leadership and effective and responsible leadership.
On to leadership on Capitol Hill and the fact, of course, that we have a dramatically different situation there than we had just had with now Republicans in pretty decisive control. And now... A budgetary process rolling, which you were telling me before we went on the air, is decidedly different from the way it used to be. And of course, we're talking about a budget agreement being hammered out, which would avert a potential government shutdown. But you were telling me that that this is a process that looks really different from the way it once did.
Well, the formal established process is the same as always, but there has been, in my view at this point, almost a childish unwillingness to cooperate where the rubber hits the road, which is taxes and spending in Congress. I don't think there'll be another government shutdown because the cost, political cost, would be too heavy. However, the Republicans like to say, especially in the House, that this White House hasn't had a budget for years. Well, the White House, in fact, comes up with a fiscal budget. You should make up your own mind about how effectively and skillfully they work at getting it through Congress. But since the Republicans took over the House in 2010, they have refused to go through the usual budgetary process. They passed their own budget and spending bills. And that is where the gridlock really becomes most apparent. There are continuing resolutions. There are ad hoc resolutions. There's a lot of cutting and pasting going on. But the budgetary process, which is constitutionally required, has been, in effect, derailed by this intense partisanship. I do think that there is room, especially for a Republican, since they now can control the Congress, the degree to which Republicans demonstrate bipartisanship at a time when the voters have made it very clear they're sick and tired of this current gridlock, which has gone on for quite a while. Very hard to do, but it's a way, you know, it can open the path to the White House, I believe, for someone who can demonstrate and publicly interest people in the process, serious bipartisanship.
I wonder if you followed the interesting story that swirled around the short-term hospitalization of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She, if I remember correctly, she was stricken while in the course of a workout. So, I mean, this is a woman in her 80s, but very vigorous for her age. But but nevertheless, stricken with some kind of, I don't remember what it was now, but like a heart palpitation or something, and required treatment and so on. Almost immediately in the wake of the announcement of her hospitalization, apparently came the call, fairly serious from some quarters, that she should think about stepping down, that is, resigning. So it would be a Democratic president, President Obama, who would be in a position to nominate a replacement for her, versus a couple of years down the road when who knows who might be in the White House and in position to make such a nomination. But it was really fascinating to me. I wondered if that had ever happened before, where somebody would, more than one person, a number of different liberal observers were rather brazenly making that suggestion. I just wonder if you can think of any time in history where a similar sort of thing was said about a Supreme Court justice step down so somebody else can be given the chance to fill your vacancy before someone from the other side of the aisle.
Yeah, it resonates with me. I don't know. I will look into it. I'm sure it has happened. The Supreme Court, there's nothing new about applying and trying to apply political pressure and a political litmus test to the Supreme Court. The conflict between FDR and a very conservative Supreme Court and his notorious effort to change the court, increase the numbers, is one of the most serious crises we've had, and he was roundly criticized for that effort, including by a lot of Democrats. But in fact, the Supreme Court did become more flexible after he scared them on the New Deal legislation. I do think it reflects the intense partisanship that of our time that's afflicted the Supreme Court. And ironically, I think it's an argument for more politicians on the Supreme Court. We have a population of very distinguished academics and activists, and several of them have made their mark as both. With very strong views and a great deal of intellectual self-confidence that's fully justified. And on the big cases, it's 5-4. Going back in time, again, to the Brown versus Board era of the 50s, Earl Warren was a qualified lawyer and had been Attorney General of California, among other things. He was Eisenhower's, when Justice Roberts died, and Eisenhower named Warren the new Chief Justice, he was confronted with a Brown versus Board decision that was clearly going to be 5-4. Earl Warren, a very talented politician, he'd been the Republican vice presidential nominee in 48 with Dewey.
I'd forgotten that.
He spent a year, he put the case on hold. He took it off the immediate docket. He spent a year consulting his colleagues, a solid year, about many things, including this, and the decision was 9-0. That is a good politician at work.
Wow. And in other words, if he had not done so, it would have been a
5-4.
A split decision and would have been a very different kind of statement.
Yes. Federal troops were sent to Little Rock by Ike for the first time since Reconstruction. That's how serious it was and remains, as we've been discussing in these terrible events. Our current Chief Justice Roberts is intellectually very distinguished. He's skillful at dealing with senators in a very complimentary, deferential, and interesting way while saying absolutely nothing during confirmation hearings. But he is not, he hasn't shown this kind of down-to-earth, backroom, kind of raw and dirty political skill that got a great result and is necessary in a democracy.
Interesting.
Well, thank you. I hope it is interesting because it's really important.
Right.
And again, it's not part of the dominant debate.
Right. No, we don't hear a lot about that. One thing we do hear a lot about is immigration policy and, of course, the President Obama's rather dramatic gesture, which I think occurred since the last time you were here on the program.
Yes.
Did you have a reaction to that you want to share with that? Do you think that what he did was appropriate and or will it be helpful?
I hope it's helpful. He's on the road again today, as he is most days. He spends a remarkable amount of time on the road as president. I certainly hope it's helpful. I wish that the administration had continued to pursue the legislative approach. Now, that's easy to say when you're an ivory tower professor, but it does seem to me reflected in going on the road to campaign for that it's a political move rather than driven by putting public policy at the top. And being president of the United States is a very tough job. I certainly admire anybody who runs for office, that office especially, and succeeds. And I voted for President Obama during your last period in office. He's not going to be running again. He can't change the Congress. That's the time to really operate as a chief executive rather than a candidate.
Mm. How would you characterize the current state of the American economy? And then we'll expand that into more of kind of a global question about globally what economically, what do things look like right now? But, I mean, for a long, long, long time now, we have been talking about a very slow recovery from the last disastrous economic downturn. And of course, the facet of job creation and regeneration of wages, that's been probably the slowest, stickiest point of the recovery. Compared to maybe other aspects of our economy, which have been a little bit more robust, particularly as we come now to the end of this calendar year. How would you characterize the current state of the American economy, and where are we in this arc of recovery?
Well, the numbers are very promising, and we should be encouraged. On the other hand, I've got a job. It's been a slow recovery. That's not necessarily bad. I do believe the Fed, the role of the Fed, we've been talking a fair amount about earlier periods in the 50s and 60s, especially in the 60s. A lot of very informed and experienced people thought that federal fiscal policy was the essential element to a strong economy. And thanks to the fact that that didn't work very well in the U.S. and countries generally, certainly in the advanced industrial countries, the role of the central bank has become central. That's a huge change, which we take for granted and we don't much discuss, and therefore that's important. It is a slow recovery, but it is also a very sure recovery. And I'm not an economist. I'm not a financier. I'm not a corporate executive. But I do know enough to know that looking at price-earnings ratios is important, and debt-to-asset ratios is also important. And just as the federal fiscal deficit is coming down dramatically, and you don't hear much about that this year as opposed to last year and the year before, we really do have a tremendous asset base in this country, and even consumer debt levels aren't as high as they were. But in the corporate world, there are good reasons for these stock market levels to be as high as they are. So there's a lot of good news, but we do really have what economists call a dual economy. I'm glad we're talking about it. We have a minority of the population that really is suffering, is hurting, people who have great long-term sustained inability to get a job, hold a job, any job. There is a culture of poverty, which, to Lyndon Johnson's credit, he gave great emphasis to and gave a lot of influence to people who'd coined and used that important term. And you really haven't had, since President Johnson's time, much sustained emphasis on the poor in this country. Even today,
right,
for all Barack Obama's liberalism. And I think it's very important that we continue to attend to this population, which is not by no means an African-American population. There are more white, very low-income people than black, many of them in the rural U.S., not in inner cities. It's extremely important that we continue this discussion. Mm. And I think a really smart Republican, since the Democrats in power haven't really addressed more than the middle class, a really smart Republican will take advantage of this, I think, and do something useful.
I don't remember if this happened since your last visit or not, but I interviewed the author of a very interesting book called Landslide, which examined...
That was just coming up when you and I talked before.
Right. And the book traces essentially the decline of LBJ.
And rise of Reagan.
And the rise of Ronald Reagan. One of the central points made in the book, which I think is intriguing, I think it's apropos to what you were just saying, is the fact that one of the biggest mistakes that President Johnson made in his desperate bid to secure some kind of permanent legacy for himself, his own kind of towering myth in the wake of the assassination of JFK, was this elevated rhetoric with which he presented the concept of the Great Society.
Yeah.
And essentially, in the view of this author at least, made very lavish promises, painted a picture of a splendid future free of poverty that nobody could possibly fulfill. And that almost from the moment it all began, it was doomed to a certain kind of failure because of the way it was presented, not as this is going to be a long, hard slog, little by little by little, and but it's, you know, here is this amazing thing which is going to solve this terrible problem. And I only bring it up because it seems to me that I absolutely agree with you. We have to talk about poverty. It seems to me maybe a cautionary lesson from this story of Lyndon Johnson is we have to be careful about the way we talk about poverty, and we have to be careful about the way we talk about the solutions that we propose, because there is no easy answer to any of these questions about poverty.
What was the name of the author?
I don't remember the name of the author.
Sorry.
The book is called Landslide.
Right.
But
I look forward to reading it. I have been reading Passage to Power, Robert Caro's, C-A-R-O, latest mammoth volume in his multi-volume, enormous, quite appropriately, biography of Lyndon Johnson. And we can all breathe a big sigh of relief, because one thing I was anxious about, Robert Caro states very explicitly that in all his thorough, never-ending lifetime research, he's found no persuasive, serious evidence that Johnson was involved in any conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. The book opens with the very end of the Kennedy administration, the assassination, and then Johnson's first period in office. Caro describes in each of these volumes Johnson's enormous interpersonal and legislative skill and his very heartfelt commitment to the poor. He was a pro forma segregationist of necessity, but he was always very much committed to helping low-income people. He was committed to civil rights, even when he would only occasionally talk about it. He helped a very, very poor young working man. He tutored him on his own, taught him how to read when Johnson was a student at Southwest State Texas Teachers College. So this populism, this old-time, raw, but very admirable populism was very much part of him. He was under tremendous time pressure. He knew that, because he knew Congress so well, that his time was limited to get his legislative program through. He had very large flaws. President Eisenhower, who met with Senate Majority Leader Johnson and Sam Rayburn every evening when they were all in town, he didn't like either one of them. He had a tremendous dislike for Johnson. He said privately that if he gets to the White House, and he may, he will go insane. And Eisenhower also said that, I think Dick will get to the White House. He'll never make it through two terms. I think there were characteristics of President Johnson's personality that brought him down. Mm. And the war, with the value of hindsight, the war in Vietnam was made to order, I think, to do that over time. But often unstable. It's important to keep in mind in an executive position or any other position, unstable people are often extremely important in terms of getting things done, at least for a while.
Mm. In our closing couple of minutes, it's not very much time to have you talk about two of the most important countries in the world, but I know that you wanted to say a little something about China, a little something about Japan. Japan, of course, is a country which has had a somewhat struggling economy for some time now. Tell us about the most recent efforts underway to, in a sense, kickstart that economy.
Prime Minister Abe has... who's getting, in effect, a second time around, very unusual in their politics. He's been beating the nationalist drum, which is always unwise, particularly unwise in the case of Japan, but within limits. They're pursuing very radical monetary and fiscal policies in an effort to get the economy going. They're very much overshadowed by China. For that reason, in the media discussion, for that reason, I think it's extremely important to be attentive to Japan, which remains, in gross numerical terms, probably still the number three economy in the world, has an enormous asset base, an enormously talented population, an economy that's slowly opening up. You can see it when you go there, and you can certainly get the hard data. An economy that was remarkably, almost totally closed until the last couple of decades in terms of foreign executives, in terms of greater visibility from women, for women from overseas as well as in their own country politically, in terms of accepting foreign investment capital. They are slowly opening up. China, again, in terms of gross numbers, has just surpassed the U.S., depending on how you measure currency values, as the largest economy in the world. But Japan has, like us, tremendous diversity of technical and professional skills. And I think it's especially important as China becomes more important, and especially given the history of terrible conflict between the two, as there is a history between us and Japan, it's extremely important that U.S. foreign policy look to Japan and Korea as well as China. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is an important, long-term, slow-moving effort to create the kind of network for trade cooperation and liberalization that has existed for decades now in Europe and the Atlantic region. I believe the president wants that to be one of his important accomplishments of his last phase in office, and I certainly hope the administration is able to work with the other major nations involved to get this agreement. That will open the door, I think, to the slow-moving, under-discussed, but extremely important opening of Japan.
Do you foresee good things in the year 2015?
Yes. Representative government is growing steadily around the world. A couple of decades ago, the only real democracy in Latin America was Costa Rica and maybe one or two others, starting in the early 1960s after the most fitful effort to have representative democracies in major South American countries. There was a return to militarism and dictatorship. The only dictatorship, a true dictatorship left in Latin America is Cuba. Even Venezuela, even when annoying Hugo Chavez was in power, he had to face the people in elections, and he had referenda, and he lost from time to time. It's a tremendous change. That, along with the rise of women, to steadily increasing prominence in politics and government and business is really very positive. We now have over 100 women in the new Congress that's coming in. I heard on public television that that's the first time, actually the last Congress for a while was a little over 100. But it's undeniable, and this is not an original point. Women, Republicans and Democrats, they talk together more, they meet more, they network more, they coalesce more than their tiresome male counterparts. And I think with a tremendous popular pressure for more bipartisanship, women legislative leaders in Congress will become even more and more important. Senator, I mentioned Dianne Feinstein. Lisa Murkowski in Alaska has taken a leading role in driving policy and attention to resources, Arctic resources, challenges and needs. The administration has been totally inert in this